Hey guys, it's Mark Potter, publisher of Canvas Magazine, and I want to welcome you to another episode of Brushstrokes. Today's episode is sponsored by Conduit Incorporated, channeling content and connections. Conduit specializes in custom content and allows you to get closer to your community. Go to www.conduit-inc.com. Guys, today's episode is a fun conversation with a gentleman by the name of Jake Walker. Jake is the CEO of CP Graphics out in Arizona, and he provides some unique perspective on our industry and what it means to build a business. You see, Jake is not from our industry. He is a finance guy, MBA, born and raised in Kansas, and he took over a business in Arizona that was about to be discarded. He's built that business to a robust, thriving, entrepreneurial type entity, and he's got a bunch of people that love to work and love to work for him. Jake has a style which is enticing. He's got great perspective. I was lucky enough to meet him a couple years ago when he tapped me on the shoulder and said he enjoyed Canvas Magazine. But after getting to know him and spending some time with him over the past couple years, his impact on me is probably just as powerful. Again, he's got a great perspective on the industry. It's not the traditional. And so without further ado, I would love for you to take a listen to my conversation with Jake Walker, CEO of CP Graphics.
Why did you get in this business?
Why am I talking to you, or why am I?
No, we here? Know why you're talking to me, because I'm
physically.
You know, awesome.
Why am I? Yeah.
Yeah.
We got in this business. I've told the story several times, but we got in this business because there was an opportunity for a deal in 2010 that were two printers, commercial printers, traditional commercial printers, one that had been a very successful, you know, been around for a while here in Tucson, that were both in bankruptcy. And there was a deal on the table to be able to acquire those two out of bankruptcy. And initially, we weren't real sure what we were going to do with it. And this deal started to go south. So I was brought in around that time to look at it and see if there was an opportunity to create something out of the ashes of those two commercial printers and spend some time figuring out, you know, can this deal be salvaged? What can we do with it? What are the opportunities? Including initially, you know, was just consideration of liquidating the assets because we were buying them for pennies on the dollar.
Right.
And it was, you know, there was some heavy equipment there. So I spent the first year just looking at the industry and seeing what the opportunity was. And one thing that I quickly noticed, and I went back to the investment team that I represented and said, you know, hey, I spent some time in the industry, very fragmented. It's in a extreme pace of transition and innovation. There's a lack of direction. There's a lack of clarity on what the industry wants to be, both the industry as a whole and the individual entities in the industry. And there's really an opportunity for disruption here to come in and look at this with a clean set of eyes and talk about possibilities and build out what possibilities could be, because everyone in the industry was kind of looking at it with, you know, experienced eyes and saying, you know, kind of praying for the days to get back to what we were, as opposed to focusing on figuring out what we were going to be or what we wanted to be.
Right.
So I went back to the team at that point and said, look, I think this is the opportunity. There's a few, with the specific operation we had, there were a few strategic objectives that we had to accomplish first, but then we were going to put together this plan to build what we thought a print-focused organization of the future could look like. And we've been working on that for the last 6 years, and I've had some challenging times. We've had some good times. We've had a lot of fun, and we're in a place now where we're starting to really develop a market force and some momentum around that transition.
What if you had to look back, and you know, obviously, entrepreneurial mindset. You've got the financials background. Heck, you even got your own little barbecue business. So when you look and you talk about, oh, it's ups and downs. Well, you're going to have that anywhere. But the biggest, what's been the biggest surprise, do you think? And maybe follow that up with, you know, the biggest learning that you've taken away over the course of the last few years?
That's a good question.
Are you surprised that you had so much fun and that you've enjoyed it so much?
No, I didn't, because I mean, that doesn't really surprise me, because that's my passion. You talked about the entrepreneurial spirit. I do have that. I've got several ventures going at the same time, but, you know, I'm a person that really thrives off of doing something others say can't be done, or doing something that others say, well, that's, you know, when I hear people say, well, that's the way we've always done it. You know, when you walk into our building, right on the front wall, is a quote, you know, that says the most dangerous word in the language is the most dangerous phrase in the language is we've always done it this way. Mm-hmm. And that's like, that gets you immediately dunce hat and then time out in our building. If you use something, you know, those words specifically or something, you know, similar to them, because, you know, we've really taken this approach and this attitude of we can be whatever we want to be, and the industry can be whatever it want to be. So, you know, I wasn't surprised about how much fun we've had, because I think that's, you know, that's fun for me. And I think I quickly put a team in place to support that and have fun with it as well. So, you know, we have a pretty strong like-minded team here.
Is that how you manage millennials? You give them timeouts?
Yeah. Yeah. How their parents manage them, you know, that's how you gotta manage.
Oh my gosh, I've been doing it wrong all these years.
Exactly. Don't yell at them. That's the worst thing you can do.
Oh my gosh.
Probably the biggest surprise was how much resistance there was from the quote unquote legacy industry and the individuals that were legacy printers to support something different or something new.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's probably a whole separate conversation around psychology and the way that the human mind works. But, it blew me away when you came in with a fresh set of eyes and you tried to challenge that way of thinking, just how much resistance was there. That was probably the biggest surprise I have. And the biggest learning I had was, you know, as we sit here today, if you look at our leadership team and you really look at our team that's guiding, my vision for the organization, there are none of those legacy print people there.
Right.
And, you know, I hate to, it pains me sometimes to say this out loud, because I feel like the industry has adopted me in some way, but I would have made those types of changes faster. I would have made more aggressive moves to go outside the industry specifically for talent than what I did.
Yeah. Well, a lot of times change comes from the outside. Mm-hmm. If you've got a baseball team that's underperforming and the competition is doing better, you change the manager. And somebody typically will come from the outside. You don't necessarily always see someone get promoted within to that role. Because they continue on.
You've seen Moneyball?
Yeah.
Brad, you know, that scene when they're in the bowels of A's Stadium and they're and they're having that conversation when he's first, talking about how they're going to scout and how they're going to develop talent. And he's got all the old baseball scouts sitting around, using all the old baseball, language and mentality and thought process. That scene was very, very similar to what I experienced early days here, in the boardroom here, talking about what the vision of the organization would be. Because keep in mind, I'm not from the industry, so I knew nothing. So I was relying on a lot of these people for learning, just basic learning and knowledge out of it. And so I couldn't, make too aggressive of moves early on until I, learned what I needed to learn. But it was a lot like that, They just keep saying the same old things, the same old way, and you just keep challenging them, And finally, I just couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah. Well, it's right. It's interesting. Like I was at, in that printer the other day, and I'm listening to somebody say, I'm doing the cold call. I'm doing this and asking. Essentially, what can I do? And it seems like the biggest thing, and I'm sure when you talk about times, tough times, ups and downs, I mean, there is no silver bullet. You can't, nobody can come to me and say, okay, Mark, what do you think I should be doing? And I go, well, here's the secret. And oh my gosh, because if somebody had the answer, it's like ROI. I mean, if somebody had... If that was a real thing, if you said, I'll do this and I will get this return, then let's go to Vegas. And
right.
So, I think that's one of the things that you've got an old recipe. And, there's some traditional thinking, but you've also got traditional recipe for sales. How do you, and I don't think that that's necessarily monopolized in the printing industry. I mean, this is for a lot of B2B environments. So... how do you see the relationship building and how has that changed? I mean, if you looked over the last 20 years, what would be your take on the change of how you sell?
I think, one of the things that have changed, one of the fundamental things that have changed about the way you sell is there's been a shift in leverage.
Right.
So 20 years ago, a while ago, the salesman had leverage. And they had leverage in the form of knowledge or information, right?
Right.
So if you wanted to learn about a product or you wanted to learn about a solution, you would reach out to that salesperson, and that salesperson would present their solution and the knowledge and the information that you need. A good salesperson would supply you with the knowledge and the information you needed to make a purchasing decision. And obviously, they would want to position their product or service in, a positive light, mm-hmm. As a good solution to what your challenge is. But what you would traditionally do, that's when people always say, you hear them when they talk about good sales, you're like, wow, I didn't even feel like I was being sold, right?
Yeah.
And that individual would sit there and have a conversation with you and understand what you're trying to solve and then try to provide you with information and knowledge for you to solve your problem. But the entire time they let you feel like you were driving the train and you were making that purchasing decision by solving your problem, not somebody just peddling you something.
Right.
So I think the biggest transition you've seen in today's world is that leverage is now shifted to the consumer. So a salesperson no longer has that leverage. You no longer are the gateway to information. There's a million stats out there that talk about how, a consumer by the time they reach out to you is, 60 to 75% through the purchasing decision already, right?
Yeah.
They've already researched what they need. They've already researched you. They've already looked at your competitors. And they're at a point that they've reached out to you to just make some kind of final informational type pieces and move on. So I think, the effective sales model today, and I think what a lot of people specific to this industry, and again, just like you said earlier, it's not just this industry. It's you see sales people across the board struggling with identifying what the new process is you know, being that source of information. And that, quite frankly, happens mostly in a digital environment right now.
Right.
You know, so, you know, if you want to start in that process and create leverage like you used to have in sales 20 years ago because you own the information, then you need to be in a position where you're providing that information to your ideal client earlier on. So when they start that process, that purchasing process, and they start the research, that either through, you know, going online and looking for information, or reaching out to people within their industry or people that are experts on what they're trying to accomplish, you want to make sure you're in that conversation earlier on, because the earlier in the conversation, the more leverage you create, because in their eyes, you're being presented as a quote-unquote knowledge expert. And then at that point, the actual sale is really about building an individual relationship, you know, just focusing on acting like you give a shit about what they actually are trying to do, making right. sure you understand what they're trying to do, and then presenting them solutions to solve their problem, not pitching them on features, specs, quality, you know, all those other things. You're not a talking, you know, websites do that now.
Yeah.
So you're just going to walk in with your sample kit, and you're going to go through, you know, the equipment list that you have. You know, and a good exercise for you is, if you're going through what your sales pitch is going to be, and that's anything that I could find without you, what value are you bringing to the conversation at that point? Why am I going to want to do business with you?
Right.
I can find that equipment set. I could go get samples. I can do that with anyone, anywhere online, and never have to deal with you. So I think that's the big shift. And there's some fundamental blocking and tackling things that I don't think the industry specifically does well before you even get to that point. Like my latest blog that's coming out next week is, you know, understanding, and you guys put out something similar and kind of inspired me, was, you know, the concept of the article is basically knowing who your yes is so you can say no. Right.
Right. Right.
And, you know, if you were talking about, like you said, if a guy were asking me, saying, okay, I'm trying to get my cold calls done, I'm trying to get sales, I'm trying to figure it out, the first exercise I would go through is say, okay, who is your ideal client? Who are the top 5 to 10 clients in this organization that you're creating the most value for and are the best clients, you know, you have the best relationship? And it may not necessarily be your biggest client, by the way.
Right.
The client that you're providing the most benefit to. Understand that, go through the process. We've got a document that you can go through and check the boxes and say, okay, what are the features that make it? Now, how do I go out and find more clients like this? So when you're going through that process, you know, like I said, it's easy to say yes. It's hard to say no. And you can't say no unless you know who you want to say yes to. So
right.
I think it's a combination of things. I think there is a major shift in this leverage value conversation. You have to approach sales from a value add perspective, not a creating leverage perspective. And then you got to have some fundamental things in there and have some strategy behind who you're going after and what you're trying to sell. You can't just say, oh, well, anyone could use print, so anyone could be a client, and anyone that brings me a job is a good client, you know?
Yeah.
And we're just going to dial next, because then guess what? That's where you end up in the, who's your current provider? What's your pricing? Let me see if I can beat it.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's not easy. So, I mean, it's when we talk about it, when I hear you talk about it and so eloquently, I mean, I kind of get goosebumps about it, because I think that's the thing. And I think we take pause for a second and say, look, you know, we're not trying to, you know, diminish people or the industry. In fact, if anything, it's quite the opposite to saying the opportunity is fantastic. I think talk about leverage, printers, this business, this industry is already in. It's already big enough. So lever that over to a new day. You know, but you've got to make that switch. You're right. I think there's a lot of people that maybe they're just trying to get to the finish line and they don't want to change. But those that start, you said something earlier about, you know, creating a legacy company. And I think that's a big deal, because your motivation has a future you're looking at the future, you're looking at something around building sustainability, that alone is where you start to think, okay, now I can invest in change and in a different recipe to build a following. I would assume, is it accurate that you are more intimately involved in your biggest pieces of business?
Oh yeah. I mean, well, first of all, in the transition process, anytime you're trying to manage the level of change that we were going through, I have to be, right?
Yeah.
Because there was no one really in the organization that could communicate the vision of what we were wanting to accomplish as well as I did, just because we didn't have enough time, you know?
Right.
Not that there's anything special to what I was doing. I just, at the time, I had the vision, and we hadn't had enough time for others to adopt and absorb and understand that. So when we were transitioning into the types of business that we want, yeah, I was very intimately involved in that. We're now finally at a point, you know, where I've got a team that I have confidence in that can do that, and we're starting to scale that conversation, and the culture has been absorbed. Like, we've met that critical mass. When you're managing change like this and you're transitioning an organization, it's really driven around the vision and the culture that you're wanting to create. And once you're able to achieve a critical mass in terms of the actual physical bodies that are in the organization that are aligned with that vision and own it, that's when you start to see momentum happen very quickly. And that happened for us a couple years ago. And then you pile on top of that, you double down on talent that starts to find you because your team mm-hmm. is so aligned mm-hmm. with that vision that the market recognizes it. You know, the market can see it, and it doesn't look like BS. So then you start to attract talent that wants to be part of that vision. They want to be aligned with that. So we've now at the point that we've created this critical mass, and our my vision and mission for the organization is being owned by others than me. Now we can scale, and now I can be less involved in some of those larger types of deals when they come. I mean, if the nature of the type of work we do, and specifically on the technology side, I have to be a little more involved sometimes, but I'm actually kind of backing out of that. And to be honest with you, we're really streamlining and downsizing that piece, you know, and especially on the business development side. We're not focused on building a massive sales organization. Mm-hmm. We're focused on building a massive sales machine mm-hmm. that drives new opportunities and new business to us, and we're doing that primarily through digital methods because that's how the world lives right now. You know, that's two things that I've spoken on quite a bit, and I've put a couple articles out as well around, you know, the two big things I think for the industry right now are the main word is collaboration, right?
Right.
My article last week, the big lesson I took out of the Olympics was, you know, remember, I'm sure you saw the distance runners, and the girl tripped and the girl stopped and helped pick her up, and they finished the race together, and then they were winning all sorts of sportsmanship awards and stuff like that. That is a perfect metaphor for where I think the industry is. We've gone through a major purge. Industry's been cut in half.
Right.
A lot of people that weren't in it for a long while, people weren't thinking about the future, people weren't trying to create a vision, weren't putting the work in, they have either been absorbed, they've gone out of business, they've been consolidated. You know, we're really at a point where, much like the Olympics, you know, when you go through a qualifying process, what's left is kind of the best of the best, in my opinion. There's a lot of really, really talented leaders and really talented companies out there that are doing really cool things. So now it's really about collaborating, and much like that, you know, that runner helping the other one up and finishing the race together, we as an industry need to start to collaborate and work together, and especially those of us that feel a passion and have a vision for what the future of the industry can be, to reach out, collaborate, talk about what's working, talk about what's not working, help each other, pick each other up, and finish the race as fast as we can. That needs to happen internally, and I think you're starting to see that happen in the industry organizations. I even referenced your group, you know, with groups like Canvas and your event Think MSP coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Are those
events that are encouraging that type of behavior. So I think that's really happening in the industry. Now, the next big challenge for the industry, and it's for media as a whole, is to reach across the aisle and say, okay, how can we collaborate and mm-hmm. work together and move forward?
Yeah.
You know, I work really closely with a couple really talented digital guys, and I'll be honest, that's one of our biggest advantages right now, because that's the reality. That's the world we live in now. Everyone's got their face in their phone, or they're sitting in front of their computer. And when you want to make a decision, what's the first thing you do? You go online. Well, yeah. If the industry isn't reaching out and participating and collaborating with the digital world and understanding social marketing and understanding, you know, online advertising and understanding content generation, if they aren't doing those things, you know, again, you're at the back of the line. And, you know, if you're going to have a seat at the table, the only value you're going to bring to the table is going to be a commodity-based pricing model, right? I mean, if I'm going to sit there and I'm the knowledge expert and I have all the information and I've shown you all the tips and tricks and I'm putting out the content on why you should be using print and how you can build, you know, a digital direct mail combo campaign and why you can do, if I'm putting all that content, that information out, and they're talking to me and they're talking to you, and you don't have any of that, and you aren't putting any effort into that, who do you think has all the leverage in that scenario?
Right.
So.
Exactly.
I don't even know what you just asked. You just got me on a rant.
I love it, man. Coming from somebody who loves rants.
I've never been on a call with you and been able to talk this much. So what's going on? Are you all right? You sick?
Brandon had... No. No, they've got me taped to the chair.
And somebody's sitting there tasing you like a shock collar. Every time you start to talk, they just hit you.
They've got a shock collar. And if I go over my time limit, then they hit me. But it's so funny. It's funny. Earlier this morning, I was interviewing a designer. And I said to her at one point, and you know, my creative director, Brandon, hates it when I say this, but I said, you know, design is a commodity. And it just doesn't mean anything. If you design a Picasso, if it doesn't resonate with the audience, it doesn't mean anything. And content, it's funny. Living in this world of content, I get a little nervous because everybody talks about it, and content can be so much noise. If you put your blog out, or if Brandon sends me something he's read, I'm going to read it. That's the way I get the distribution model is just as important in right. content. And whether it's a sales rep, if a sales rep is knocking on a door, that's a distribution model for content. And it might not be the model that they want to use because it's not a trusted entity. But if their best friend sends them a piece of content, whether it's a picture or it's an article or whatever, I agree with that. And I think that the salespeople today should be looking at this going, you know, listen to what Jake is saying. It's a very sophisticated role going forward, but there's got to be some other top of the funnel stuff there.
Well, there is, and it's a very sophisticated role, and you got to be strategic, and you got to be committed to continuing that. I mean, that's one thing. Think about it. I mean, go to all the events. Go to DScoop. Go to Graph Expo. Go to any of them. Show me one print industry strategic sales class session. Anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a couple guys out there, I think like Matt Parker and a couple people that put some stuff out that are, you know, they're putting out some content, some blogs around, you know, mm-hmm. selling type stuff, but there's no one training or educating these individuals on how to do it. Because just like you talked about, your content point, you touched on it. All right, people, like, I'm with you. Content marketing, like, is a major buzzword. And unfortunately, much like what, the trading platforms, you know, financial trading platforms did to, to the trade world, mm-hmm. you know, when E-Trade and all those come out, all of a sudden everybody was a fucking day trader, right?
Yeah.
And I never forget, I owned a bar in college, and I would, you know, be behind the bar, and there's two guys one time in Kansas, and they were middle-aged men, and, you know, these platforms had just came out, and they're sitting there, and they're proclaimed day traders, and they'd always come in at lunch, and they'd want me to turn it on, I don't know, CNBC or one of the, you know, anyone that had a ticker going.
Right, right, right.
ticker the entire time. And they would talk about their trades, and they would talk about their trades in terms of their stock symbols. They wouldn't even know what the organizations were, right? They'd be like, oh, well, CXP is really, really killing, you know, and they would sit there and have this whole conversation, and they were day traders. Well, it was just humorous to me because the guys knew nothing about, there was no strategy to what it was. They were basically just watching trends, watching reports, and then they would execute and they would do things because the technology was cheap and now available for them to do it. They had access to the market.
Right.
Well, content marketing is not that much different now. Unfortunately, anyone with a fucking internet connection, pardon my French, they're now an internet marketer. They're now a blog. They're now a content creator. They're now an entrepreneur.
Yep.
And, you know, so people jump on, they just start put out. And I'm speaking from this, again, as a practitioner from experience. Like, I'm not preaching down academic that sit here and saying, I wrote a book on this. I'm telling you about somebody that executes this stuff on a daily basis and has executed it pretty well, given what our organizations have done.
Mm-hmm.
But even in the beginning when I started my own stuff, it was the same thing. I started being, you know, general, just putting out content. Well, if you're truly going to do content marketing, you need a strategic plan just like you would any other type of marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And content marketing is a very, very strong tool for you as an individual, as a salesperson, for an organization or an individual as a salesperson, mm-hmm. for the same reasons I was bagging on it a minute ago. It's so cheap and easy for you to get into it and get access, but you have to have a very specific strategy about who you want reading your content. And it's very simple. You think about who, that same conversation I had earlier, who is my ideal client? Who is my yes? Who do I want? All right, this is who I want. All right, what questions are they asking? What conversations are they having? And what concerns do they have that I can help provide a solution to?
Right.
And then all you have to do is write content, research, put the work out to answer those questions, and then put the content in front of those individuals.
Right.
And that's a very easy way to build rapport, to build value. And that is a very, very powerful tool as a salesperson in today's environment. I really push our sales and account managers. You know, I tell them they got to get more active on the social platforms. They got to be more active on LinkedIn. Like, I'm not going to make you sit down and write a blog post every week because it's even a struggle for me to do it. But, you know, the more you can be present in front of the types of people that we want to attract to our organization, the more success you're going to have. But you need to have a strategy there. You can't just call yourself a content creator and just start throwing stuff out and publishing it, and you don't have a way to build your list, and you don't have a strategy or a plan for getting it in front of the people that would actually want to read it. You're just going to get buried and lost in all the other crap. And I think that's why a lot of people jump into digital strategies early on and content strategies early on, and they don't see any major return or ROI out of it right out the gate, and then they bag it and say, oh, well, you know, that stuff doesn't work. Nobody does that. Well, don't blame the content for your lack of strategy and inability to execute.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree. We'll commoditize the shit out of anything. I mean, if it wasn't, you know, QR codes, it was social marketing. If it wasn't social marketing, it was, content marketing. It's the next greatest thing, you know, and marketers will jump on something, and content marketing is. It's a buzzword. We think things get buzzworthy, and then we jump all over and we commoditize them. And technology certainly pushes us towards the disintermediation of people and roles. Doesn't necessarily mean that that there won't be other roles created. But the other thing is, when you're talking, I'm sitting there thinking about the old joke, you know, with the two bulls, the old bull and the young bull on the top of the hill. And you know, the young bull says, you know, let's run down there and grab one of them cows. It's probably, that's the G-rated version. And the old bull says, no, let's walk down and grab them all. And I think one of the things that technology in the world does to us is that we jump on something and we think we have to immediately scale. We have to immediately scale something. And it's the same with content. In fact, we're looking at our Canvas site and we're going, there's too much content on there. Ain't nobody going in there and looking at all those articles. It's got to be, I'd rather have one fabulous article that was shared from friends to other friends. I mean, it's how we built Canvas. It's all permission based. And, you know, the traditional trade rags, you know, they were like, hey, let me just send this out to everybody. And most of them are dead and buried. And so it's the same in sales, I think. And I think you're exactly right. There's a sincerity that you're touching upon that is hard. I mean, it sounds beautiful in some respects, and it sounds like a really noble and nice way to go about things, but it's really hard, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it is, and you got to put the work. You got to have a plan, and you got to put the work in, and you got to be consistent. You know, the challenge I see in the industry is that typically everyone does their biggest sales work when, you know, sales suck, right?
Yeah.
You know, we all know that. We just had a, you know. And I've been guilty of it myself. You know, you have a down month, and everybody jumps in and says, "All right, we got to get on the phones. We got to go." Well, you know, in today's world, you know, people don't move that fast, right? That's a 30. The odds of you getting somebody on the day that, you know, they said, "You know what? We need to find a new printer for this project and this project and this project," and you happen to call on that day, and it, you know, everything starts to lay forward, and you get jobs right out the gate. That just doesn't happen. And if you don't have a strategy in place, and you aren't building a constant pipeline and investing in and creating new relationships, you know, it just doesn't happen. It's got to be a consistent strategic effort. It can't be a responsive, you know, off-the-cuff effort because, oh, crap, you know, we need to get some more business in because we got bills due next month, you know?
Yeah, I hear you. Well, let me ask you this. We'll kind of close with this because it's completely different. It's still relevant. What do you think about your kids and what they're going to do?
In terms of jobs or?
Yeah. Like, I mean, what do you think? I mean, doesn't that keep you up at night? Keeps me up at night, man.
My kids are 4 and 6.
That's what I mean. I mean, they're young, and but mine are 13, 11, and.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think.
Generationally, I'm thinking it. You know, it's a way to phrase the question of, you know, my God, what's this place going to look like? I mean, by the time, you know, let's say 20 years, 15 to 20 years, they're going to be thinking about careers and jobs and.
You know, I think the principles and the careers and the jobs, unless, you know, it's really popular right now. You're seeing, you know, the jobs that, or the careers that won't exist in 20 years, right? You're seeing a lot of articles and a lot of content around that.
Right.
And, you know, the argument there is anything that is some sort of, like, basically digitized or automated procedure is going to go, i.e. accounting, right? I mean, So I got a good friend that's retiring from a firm. It's a pretty large firm here in the Southwest. And, you know, he was asking what the future would look like. And you know, those guys, even at the big successful firms, they no longer want the, you know, the person that wants the quick tax, you know, file my return, right? If there is an application to your needs in terms of wealth management or, you know, leveraging tax opportunities, you know, they just don't create any value. So they've really taken a strategic approach to targeting clients that they bring value to, somebody that has some sophistication to their need. They won't even take on a, you know, hey, I need my tax return filed type client. So I think you're going to see those types of positions obviously go away. And as technology improves and as, you know, the ability to automate some of these things improves and changes in consumer behavior happen. You know, a lot of those types of positions are going to go away. But we're still going to need leaders.
Yeah.
And still going to need people that are going to, I think, develop relationships and manage. So I don't think sales in some capacity or form is ever going away. You're still going to need the people that understand how to influence people and how to inspire people, both from a leadership aspect and from a sales aspect. And I think what you're starting to see is some of our greater leaders are some of our best salespeople right now, right?
Yeah.
You're not seeing as many COO types that are stronger, you know, analytical type people because, you know, in all fairness, we can build technology around that. That can give us that information and manage that type of process, right?
Right.
So what you're seeing now is the great leaders that are building new organizations are the people that are, you know, not coincidentally great salespeople.
Yeah.
You know, they're able to really inspire, influence, you know, people, whether that is to participate in the vision of their organization or if it's to buy their product.
I got to tell you this. So I'm on the plane. I don't even know what day it is right now, but I was on the plane the other day, and I'm sitting, and a young woman gets on the plane, and she is a flight attendant, but she's piggybacking or whatever they call it. She's jumping on a flight to go to where she, and she, we start talking, and she's telling me, I said, so you live in Atlanta, but you're based out of Fort Lauderdale. And she said, yeah, the love of my life lives in Atlanta. I said, all right, well, tell me how you met your love of your life. And they met on Match.com and these dating sites or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I start to think to myself, well, I'm asking her all about it. And it's that they go through this whole filtering process and, you know, clearly they both were looking for someone, and she's 24 years old. And she's 24 years old. She's like, I didn't want to go to the bars anymore. I didn't want to meet, these jerks and blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking to myself, when I was younger, I mean, those experiences, I met a lot of people, and it was, you know, going through that was important. Anyways, it made
I'm sorry. You got me jacked up again. Go ahead, finish real quick.
Well, so let me finish this, and then I'll let you take it. So I'm curious now. Like, what's the divorce rate of people who meet on these online dating? Is it any different than traditional? And, you know, I don't think there's any hard data, but there are certainly a multitude of articles that say things like you're three times more likely to be divorced if you've met online. And, you know, but either way, you could probably suggest that there's not really a big difference. And it says what you were saying is, we're still human beings. We still need human interaction. We still need, you know, chemistry, if you will. You can't just data your way through it all on one side of the coin. So that goes to what you were talking about with salespeople.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, so to get back to your question around my kid.
Yeah.
In the professional world, there is a very large, along the lines of what you're just talking about too, there's a very, very large warranted concern for sales and leadership as a general profession, because there's less and less people coming out that know how to interact with other people. You know, the kids that are coming out of college and stuff, you know, these are kids that are spending a lot of time in a digital world, right?
Yeah.
This is their primary form of communication. They are in chat rooms, they email, they're online gaming, they're finding people on Match.com because they don't want to go and socialize and interact. There's a legitimate concern in sales of the profession that, you know, that pool is getting, that are coming in with those types of raw skills is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about, and it's just the way I look at the world, I guess, and the way I think about business, when you talk about, you know, what's the vision for my kids? I want to give my kids the technical and human dynamic skills to be able to influence people and lead people.
Right.
If I can give them a core set of skills around, you know, being able to communicate, being able to, you know, identify breakdowns, being able to manage breakdowns, being able to, you know, understand what someone is trying to accomplish and provide them solutions. You know, these aren't technical school type skills, right? Mm-hmm. So they're going to go through, they're going to get all the technical skills they need. They're going to learn their math, they're going to learn their English, they're going to learn whatever they need. What I want to do as a parent is make sure I am putting them in an opportunity for success down the road, that if they have very strong human dynamic skills and are able to work on influence people and be able to conduct themselves in those types of environment and be seen as a leader. You know, you talk about natural born leaders. There aren't natural born leaders. There are people that just put themselves out there and develop skills early on to be in a leadership position, and others that haven't just look to them and say, I will follow you. You know, yeah. I want kids to be in that position, because you're right. What they're actually doing or what organization they're working with, I have no idea. But guess what? Those skills are transferable across anything.
Right.
And I think that gives them the best opportunity for success.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that, you know, the human piece allows you to listen, you know, and that's where it's hard no matter how, yes, there's a certain level of technology that will allow you to listen properly, you know, and analyze the data. But real listening comes from an intimacy that maybe only human interaction takes place. I think that's where the content piece is starting to miss the beat. These people who are jumping on the next thing saying, well, I got to have a content plan. They're not realizing that the process of publishing, you know, I live this. And this is where I still feel like we have a tremendous competitive advantage, because we're talking about the sincerity of doing stories that matter, but then also listening and recycling that and saying, you know, we're constantly tapping into the market. I'm not just grabbing some article off the web and throwing it on my website and with no listening mechanism. Now, that listening mechanism might be, hey, I've just created subscribers. I just created people who are sharing it. Maybe there are live, but and then as you go down that funnel, there's a live interaction, and I just think that's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, you buy when you make a decision, like when you make a purchasing decision. Technology allows you to scale and access more data quicker, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, you still make a decision based on your interpretation of something, right? I mean, why the hell, if everybody just made purchasing decisions based on data, why the hell would everyone own a fucking Apple device, you know?
Right.
I mean, you know, so there's a lot of leverage and a lot of power into tapping into the psyche, the human psyche, and helping them make purchasing decisions based on that, which those are all around, you know, identity. What do I want to look like? You know, how do I want to be presented? You know, Apple is considered a tech innovator and a creative community. You know, that's how I want. That's what I want my identity and my market force to be. So I'm going to align myself with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the bigger part of these types of strategies that people I don't think are quite understanding and identifying, you know? I mean, yeah, I could go on forever for that, but I think you're right. I think the technology is simply the platform. It's simply the tool.
Mm-hmm.
The conversation and the content, whatever it be, you know, the research, whatever you're trying to use technology to accomplish, at the end of the day, there's still going to be a human interaction and decisions going to be based on a psychological impact. You know what I mean? Like, if it comes down to buying this product versus this product, you know, this product's a premium brand, or this product's the industry leader, or this product's the cheap, you know, whatever your core values and whatever your core principles are in making that decision making are what's going to drive that. So that's why I was pushing so hard earlier on a strategic sales strategy, which also needs to be part of your content strategy around understanding how you want to be perceived in the marketplace, understanding who puts the most value on that type of perception, and then find them and answer their questions and provide them solutions and put yourself in front of them as much as you can. I mean, it's pretty simple stuff. But if you don't have that strategy and you don't understand that and you don't make those decisions, then you're not going to do it. For example, when I started putting out my content at first, mm-hmm. I put it out general. It was kind of leadership type stuff. Well, guess how many, you know, leadership content creators there are in the world and how much noise is around that? Well, it's going to take me forever to get traction in this huge pool of people. Well, the minute I start pointing conversations towards leadership as it relates to the print industry, or sales as it relates to the print industry, or what our learnings have been in transitioning print, all of a sudden I've gone to an audience that I can create a lot more value for, that is looking for my type of product, and I'm in a smaller pool, so I can leverage it. And that, you know, that was a learning that I had to go through. Like I said, I'm a practitioner. That was a learning I had to go through the hard way. You know, putting content out, and there being no traction, and saying, you know, maybe we're just pointing this at the wrong place. And then it was like, well, we don't even really know who we're pointing this at.
Right.
You know, we're going to this large pool. And it wasn't until we sat down and started having those strategic conversations and putting together plans that we started to see traction happen. And then at that point, you're truly creating value. Now you're making a difference. Now you're providing a service. You're not content marketing. You're providing a service.
Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Brush Strokes. My thanks to Jake Walker, CEO of CP Graphics. I told you he had some great insight. He had a unique perspective, and I just can't thank him enough for sharing his stories and perspective with us. I think it's kind of the wave of the future. Printers should be in the business of building businesses, and Jake is an example of that. Again, thanks to him for joining our show. Another shout out to Conduit Incorporated. Want to thank them for their sponsorship. Please visit www.conduit-inc.com for all your custom content needs. And remember to go to thecanvasmag.com or subscribe on iTunes to Brushstrokes to listen to all the episodes. We can't thank you enough for joining us. We hope you have a wonderful week. And until next time, this has been Brushstrokes. Take care.